cause. The superstition exhibition, you see, is terribly important. The museum spent millions it didn't really have to put it together. It's vital that admissions be increased to keep the museum from slipping into the red. This exhibition is seen as the best way to do that.
I see, Pendergast said. He picked up a fossil lying on a table next to his chair, turning it over idly in his hand.
Ammonite?
He asked.
Correct,
replied Frock. Dr. Frock, Pendergast began. Pressure is now being brought to bear from a variety of quarters. As a result, I must be doubly careful to conduct this investigation by the book. I can't share our results with outside entities such as yourself, even when the conventional avenues of investigation are proving fruitless. He put down the fossil carefully and crossed his arms.
That said, do I understand correctly that you are an expert on DNA?
Frock nodded.
That's partly true. I have devoted some study to how genes affect morphology, the shape of an organism, and I oversee the projects of various graduate students, such as Gregory Kawakita and Margot here, whose studies involve DNA research.
Pendergast retrieved his briefcase, snapped it open, and withdrew a fat computer printout.
I have a report on DNA from the claw found in one of the first victims. Of course, I can't show it to you. It would be highly irregular. The New York office wouldn't like it.
I see, said Frock.
And you continue to believe that the claw is your best clue?
It's our only clue of importance, Dr. Frock.
Let me explain my conclusions. I believe we have a madman loose in the museum. He kills his victims in a ritualistic fashion, removes the back of the skull, and extracts the hypothalamus from the brain.
For what purpose? Asked Frock.
Pendergast hesitated.
We believe he eats it.
Margot gasped.
The killer may be hiding in the museum's sub-basement, Pendergast continued. There are many indications that he has returned there after killing, but so far we've been unable to isolate a specific location or retrieve any evidence. Two dogs were killed during searches. As you probably know, it's a perfect warren of tunnels, galleries, and passages, spread over several subterranean levels, the oldest dating back almost 150 years. The museum has been able to furnish me with maps covering only a small percentage of its total area. I call the killer he, because the force used in the killings indicates a male and a strong one at that.
Almost preternaturally strong.
As you know, he uses some kind of three-clawed weapon to disembowel his victims, who are apparently chosen at random. We have no motive. Our interviews with selected museum staff have turned up no leads as yet.
He looked at Frock.
You see, Doctor, our best clue remains our only clue. The weapon. The claw. That is why I continue to search for its origin.
Frock nodded slowly.
You mentioned DNA.
Pendergast waved the computer printout.
The lab results have been inconclusive, to say the least.
He paused.
I can see no reason not to tell you that the test on the claw turned up DNA from various species of gecko, in addition to human chromosomes. Hence our assumption that the sample might be degraded.
Gecko, you say?
Frock murmured in mild surprise.
And it eats the hypothalamus. How extraordinary. Tell me, how do you know?
We found traces of saliva and teeth marks.
Human teeth marks?
No one knows.
And the saliva?
Indeterminate.
Frock's head sank down on his chest. After a few minutes, he looked up.
You continue to call the claw a weapon, he said. I assume, then, that you continue to believe the killer is human.
Pendergast closed up his briefcase.
I simply don't see any other possibility. Do you think, Dr. Frock, an animal could decapitate a body with surgical precision, punch a hole in the skull and locate an internal organ the size of a walnut, that only someone trained in human anatomy could recognize? And the killer's ability to elude our searches of the sub-basement has been impressive.
Frock's head sunk on his chest again. As the seconds ticked off into minutes, Pendergast remained motionless, watching. Frock suddenly raised his head.
"Mr. Pendergast,"
he said, his voice booming. Margot jumped.
"I've heard your theory. Would you care to hear mine?"
Pendergast nodded.
"Of course." "Very well,"
Frock replied.
"Are you familiar with the Transvaal Shales?"
"I don't believe so," said Pendergast.
"The Transvaal Shales were discovered in 1945 by Alistair van Vrouwenhoek, a paleontologist with South Africa's Witwatersrand University. They were Cambrian, about 600 million years old, and they were full of bizarre life forms, the likes of which had never been seen before or since. Asymmetrical life forms, not showing even the bilateral symmetry of virtually all animal life on Earth today. They occurred, coincidentally, at the time of the Cambrian mass extinction. Now, most people, Mr. Pendergast, believe the Transvaal Shales represent a dead end of evolution, life experimenting with every conceivable form before settling down to the bilaterally symmetric form you see today.
But you do not hold such a view, Pendergast said.
Frock cleared his throat.
Correct. A certain type of organism predominates in these shales. It had powerful fins and long suction pads and oversized crushing and tearing mouthparts. Those mouthparts could saw through rock, and the fins allowed it to move at 20 miles per hour through the water. No doubt it was a highly successful and quite savage predator. It was, I believe, too successful. It hunted its prey into extinction, and then quickly became extinct itself. It thus caused the minor mass extinction at the end of the Cambrian era. It, not natural selection, killed off all the other forms of life in the Transvaal Shales.
Pendergast blinked. And?
I've run computer simulations of evolution, according to the new mathematical theory of fractal turbulence. The result? Every 60 to 70 million years or so, life starts getting very well adapted to its environment. Too well adapted, perhaps. There is a population explosion of the successful life forms. Then, suddenly, a new species appears out of the blue. It is almost always a predatory creature, a killing machine. It tears through the host population, killing, feeding, multiplying, slowly at first, then ever faster.
Frock gestured toward the sandstone fossil plaque on his desk.
Mr. Pendergast, let me show you something.
The agent stood up and moved forward.
This is a set of tracks made by a creature that lived during the Upper Cretaceous,
Frock continued.
Right on the KT boundary, to be exact. This is the only such fossil of its kind we've found. There is no other.
KT?
Asked Pendergast.
Cretaceous Tertiary. It's the boundary that marks the mass extinction of the dinosaurs.
Pendergast nodded, but still looked puzzled.
There is a connection here that has so far gone unnoticed,
Frock continued.
The figurine of Mbuun, the claw impressions made by the killer, and these fossil tracks.
Pendergast looked down.
Mbuun? The figurine that Dr. Cuthbert removed from the crates and put on display?
Frock nodded.
How old are these prints?
Approximately 65 million years old. They came from a formation where the very last of the dinosaurs were found. Before the mass extinction, that is.
There was another long silence.
Ah, and the connection?
Asked Pendergast after a moment.
I said that nothing in the anthropology collections matches the claw marks, but I did not say there were no representations, no sculptures of such a claw. We've learned that the forelimbs on the figurine of Mbuun have three claws with a thickened central digit. Now look at these tracks,
Frock said, pointing to the fossil. Think back to the reconstruction of the claw and the claw marks in the victim.
So you think, Pendergast said, that the killer might be the same animal that made these tracks? A dinosaur?
Margot thought she detected amusement in Pendergast's voice. Frock looked at the agent, shaking his head vigorously.
No, Mr. Pendergast, not a dinosaur. Nothing as common as a dinosaur. We're talking about the proof of my theory of aberrant evolution. You know my work. This is the creature I believe killed off the dinosaurs.
Pendergast remained silent. Frock leaned closer to the FBI agent.
I believe, he said, this creature, this freak of nature, is the cause of the dinosaurs' extinction. Not a meteorite, not a change in climate, but some terrible predator. The creature that made the tracks preserved in this fossil. The embodiment of the Callisto effect. It was not large, but it was extremely powerful and fast. It probably hunted in cooperative packs and was intelligent. But because super predators are so short-lived, they aren't well represented in the fossil record, except in the Transvaal Shales, and in these tracks here, from the Tsungjin Badlands. Are you following me?
Yes.
We are in a population explosion today.
Pendergast remained silent.
Human beings, Mr. Pendergast, Frock continued, his voice rising. 5,000 years ago, there were only 10 million of us on the globe. Today, there are 6 billion. We're the most successful form of life the Earth has ever seen.
He tapped the copies of Fractal Evolution that lay on his desk.
Yesterday, you asked about my next book. It will constitute an extension of my theory on the Callisto effect, applying it to modern life. My theory predicts that at any moment, some grotesque mutation will come about, some creature that will prey on the human population. I'm not saying the killer is the same creature that killed off the dinosaurs, but a similar creature. Well, look at these tracks again. They look like Mbun. We call it convergent evolution, where two creatures look alike not because they're necessarily related, but because they evolve to do the same thing. A creature that's evolved to kill. There are too many similarities, Mr. Pendergast.
Pendergast brought his briefcase onto his lap. I'm afraid you've lost me, Dr. Frock.
Don't you see? Something came back in that crate from South America. Unleashed in the museum. A highly successful predator. That figurine of Mbun is the proof. The indigenous tribes were aware of this creature and built a religion around it. Whittlesey inadvertently sent it into civilization.
You've seen this figurine yourself?
Pendergast asked. Dr. Cuthbert seemed reluctant to show it to me.
No, Frock admitted. But I have it on the best authority. I plan to make my own observations at the earliest opportunity.
Dr. Frock, we looked into the matter of the crates yesterday, Pendergast said. Dr. Cuthbert assured us there was nothing of value in them, and we have no reason to disbelieve him.
He stood up, impassive.
I thank you for your time and help. Your theory is most interesting, and I truly wish I could subscribe to it.
He shrugged.
However, my own opinion remains unchanged for the time being. Forgive me for being blunt, but I hope you will be able to separate your conjectures from the cold facts of our investigation and help us in any way you can.
He walked toward the door.
Now, I hope you'll excuse me. I'm going to have to see this madman caught before the end of the day, or I'll have no choice but to delay the opening. If anything comes to mind, please contact me.
And he left. Frock sat in his wheelchair, shaking his head.
What a shame, he murmured. I had high hopes for his cooperation, but it seems he's like all the rest.
Margot glanced at the table next to the chair Pendergast had just vacated.
Look, she said. He left the DNA printout.
Frock's eyes followed Margot's.
Then he chuckled. I assume that's what he meant by anything else coming to mind.
He paused.
Perhaps he isn't like all the rest after all.
Well, we won't tell on him, Margot, will we? He said, picking up the phone.
Dr. Frock to speak with Dr. Cuthbert.
A pause.
Hello, Ian. Yes, I'm fine, thank you. No, it's just that I'd like to get into the Superstition exhibition right away.
What's that?
Yes, I know it's been sealed, but... No, I'm quite reconciled to the idea of the exhibition. It's just that...
I see.
Margot noticed Frock's face redden.
In that case, Ian, Frock continued, I should like to re-examine the crates from the Whittlesey expedition. Yes, the ones in the secure area. I know we saw them yesterday, Ian.
There was a long silence. Margot could hear a faint squawking.
Now look here, Ian, Frock said. I'm chairman of this department, and I have a right to... Don't you speak to me that way, Ian! Don't you dare!
Frock was shaking with rage in a way Margot had never seen before. His voice had dropped almost to a whisper.
Sir, you have no business in this institution. I shall be making a formal grievance to the director.
Frock slowly returned the phone to its cradle, his hand trembling. He turned toward Margot, fumbling for his handkerchief.
Please, forgive me.
I'm surprised, said Margot. I thought that as a chairman... She couldn't quite complete the sentence.
I had complete control over the collections,
Frock smiled, his composure returning.
So did I. But this new exhibition and these killings have aroused sentiments in people that I hadn't suspected. Technically, Cuthbert outranks me. I'm not sure why he's doing this. It would have to be something profoundly embarrassing, something that would delay or prevent his precious exhibition from opening.
He thought for a minute.
Perhaps he's aware of this creature's existence. After all, he was the one who moved the crates. Perhaps he found the hatched eggs, made the connection, hid them, and now he wants to deny me my right to study it.
He sat forward in the wheelchair and balled his fists.
Dr. Frock, I don't think that's a real possibility, Margot warned.
Any thoughts she'd had of telling Frock about Rickman's removal of the Whittlesey Journal evaporated. Frock relaxed.
You're right, of course. This isn't the end of it, though, you can be sure. Still, we don't have time for that now, and I trust your observations of Mbun.
But, Margot, we must get in to see those crates.
How? Said Margot.
Frock slid open a drawer of his desk and fished around for a moment. Then he withdrew a form which Margot immediately recognized, a 1014, request for access.
My mistake, he went on, was in asking.
He started to fill out the form longhand.
But doesn't that need to be signed by central processing?
Margot asked.
Of course, said Frock. I will send the form to central processing via the usual procedure, and I'll take the unsigned copy down to the secure area and bully my way in. No doubt the request form will be denied, but by the time that happens, I will have had time to examine the crates and find the answers.
But Dr. Frock, you can't do that, Margot replied in a shocked tone.
Why not?
Frock smiled wryly.
Frock, a pillar of the museum establishment, acting in an unorthodox manner? This is too important for such considerations.
I didn't mean that, Margot continued.
She let her gaze drop to the scientist's wheelchair. Frock looked down. His face fell.
Ah. Yes, he said slowly. I see what you mean.
Crestfallen, he started to return the paper to his desk.
Dr. Frock, Margot said, give me the form. I'll take it down to the secure area.
Frock's hand froze. He looked at Margot appraisingly.
I asked you to be my eyes and ears, but I didn't ask you to walk over coals for me, he said. I'm a tenured curator, a relatively important figure. They wouldn't dare sack me, but you...
He drew a deep breath, raised his eyebrows.
They could make an example of you, expel you from the PhD program, and I'd be powerless to prevent it.
Margot thought for a moment. I have a friend who's very clever at this kind of thing. I think he could talk his way into or out of any situation. Frock remained motionless for a moment. Then he tore off the copy and gave it to her. I'll have the original delivered upstairs. I have to if we're going to maintain the facade. The guard may call central processing to verify receipt. You won't have much time. As soon as it comes in, they'll be on the alert. You will have to be gone by then. From a desk drawer, he withdrew a yellow paper and a key. He showed them to Margot. This paper holds the combination to the secure area vaults, he said. And here's the key to the vault itself. All directors have them. With luck, Cuthbert won't have thought to change the combinations. He handed them to Margot. These will get you through the doors. It's the guards you'll have to deal with. He was talking fast now, his eyes locked on Margot's. You know what to look for in the crates. Any evidence of eggs, living organisms, even cult objects associated with the creature. Anything that can prove my theory. Check the smaller crate first, Whittlesey's crate. That's the one that contained the Mbun figure. Check the others if you have time, but for heaven's sake, expose yourself to as little risk as possible. Go now, my dear. And Godspeed. The last thing Margot saw as she left the office was Frock beneath the bow windows, his broad back turned away from her, drumming his fists repeatedly against the arms of his wheelchair. Damn this thing, he was saying. Damn it to hell! 30. 5 minutes later, in her office several floors below, Margot picked up the phone and dialed. Smithback was in a rare mood. As Margot explained Moriarty's discovery of the deleted accession record and, in somewhat less detail, the events in Frock's office, his mood grew even more cheerful. She heard him chuckling.
Was I right about Rickman or what? Concealing evidence. Now I'll make her see the book my way, or...
Smithback, don't you dare. This isn't for your personal gratification. We don't know the story behind that journal, and we can't worry about it right now. We have to get into those crates, and we only have a few minutes to do it.
All right, all right. Meet me at the landing outside entomology. I'm leaving now.
I never thought Frock could be such a radical, Smithback said. My respect for the old feller has just gone up 2 notches.
He was making his way down a long flight of iron stairs. They'd taken a back way in hopes of avoiding the police checkpoint set up at all elevator banks.
You've got the key and the combination, right? He asked from the bottom of the stairs.
Margot checked her carryall, then followed him. She glanced quickly up and down the corridor. You know how the hall outside the secure area has lighted alcoves along it? You go ahead, I'll follow a minute later. Talk to the guard, try to draw him into an alcove where the light is better, or on the pretext of showing him this form. Get him to turn his back for a couple of minutes, and then I'll unlock the door and go in. Just keep him occupied. You're a good talker.
That's your plan? Smithback scoffed. All right.
He spun on his heels, continued down the corridor, and vanished around the corner. Margot waited, counting to 60. Then she moved forward, pulling on a pair of latex gloves. Soon she could hear Smithback's voice, already raised in righteous protest.
This paper is signed by the chairman of the department himself. Are you trying to tell me that...
She poked her head around the corner. About 50 feet down the hall was an intersection with another hallway that led to the police barricades. Further down was the door to the secure area itself. And beyond that, Margot could see the guard. He had his back to her and was holding her form in one hand.
I'm sorry, sir, she could hear him say, but this hasn't gone through processing. You're not looking in the right place, Smithback responded. Take it over here where you can read it, here in the light.
They moved down the hall away from Margot, into an illuminated alcove. As they disappeared from view, Margot came around the corner and walked briskly down the hall. At the secure area door, she inserted the key and pushed, gingerly. The door swung open on oiled hinges. She peered around the edge to make sure she was alone. The darkened room seemed empty, and she eased the door shut behind her. Her heart was already racing, the blood pounding in her ears. She caught her breath, fumbled for the light switch. The vaults stretched ahead of her in rows to the left and right. When she noticed the third door on the right had a yellow evidence sheet taped to it, she grasped its dial with one hand, and took out Frock's scrap of paper with the other. 56, 77, 23. She took a deep breath and began, remembering the locker she'd once used to store her oboe in high school music class. On the right, left, right. There was a loud click. Immediately, she grabbed the lever and pulled downward. The door opened. Inside, the crates were dim shapes against the far wall. She turned on the light and glanced at her watch. 3 minutes had passed. She had to work very quickly now. She could see the ragged marks where one of the larger crates had been torn and splintered apart. The marks sent shivers down her spine. Kneeling in front of the smaller crate, she removed its top and plunged her hands into the packing material, parting the stiff fibers to expose the artifacts. Her hand closed around something hard. Pulling it out, Margot saw a small stone carved with odd designs. Not very promising. She exposed a collection of what looked like jade lip plugs, then flint arrowheads, some points, a blowgun tube with a set of darts, long and sharp, the tips blackened with some hardened substance. Don't want to be pricked by those, she thought. Still, nothing worth taking. She delved deeper. The next layer held a small plant press screwed shut, a damaged shaman's rattle covered in grotesque designs, and a beautiful manta made of woven cloth and feathers. On an impulse, she stuffed the plant press, covered with packing fibers, into her bag. The stone disc and rattle followed. On the bottom layer, she found several jars containing small reptiles, colorful but nothing out of the ordinary. 6 minutes had passed. She sat up, listening, expecting any moment to hear the footsteps of the returning guard. But there was nothing. She hastily stuffed the rest of the artifacts back into the crate and surrounded them with packing material. She picked up the lid, noting its loose inner lining. As she pried the lining away, curiously, a brittle, water-damaged envelope slipped out into her lap. Hastily, she crammed it into her bag. 8 minutes. There was no time left. Back in the central room, she listened, trying to make out the muffled sounds outside. She eased the door open a crack. "What's your badge number?" Smithback was saying loudly. Margot couldn't make out the guard's reply. She slipped out and shut the door behind her, quickly peeling off her gloves and stuffing them into her carryall. She straightened up, looked herself up and down, then started walking past the alcove where Smithback and the guard were standing. "Hey!" she turned. The guard, flushed, was looking at her. "Oh, there you are, Bill," she said, thinking fast, hoping the guard hadn't seen her come out the door. "Am I too late? Have you already been inside?"
"This guy won't let me in," Smithback complained. "Listen, you," the guard said, turning back to Smithback. "I've told you 1,000 times, and I won't tell you again. That form has to be properly processed before I can give you access, understand?"
They'd pulled it off. Margot looked back down the hall. In the distance, she saw a tall, lean figure approaching. Ian Cuthbert. She grabbed Smithback's arm. "We've got to go. Remember our appointment? We'll have to look at the collection some other time."
"That's right, of course," Smithback babbled heartily. "I'll get this taken care of later," he said to the guard.
Near the far end of the hall, she pushed Smithback into an alcove.
"Get behind those cabinets," Margot whispered.
They heard Cuthbert's footsteps behind them as they concealed themselves. Then the footsteps stopped, and Cuthbert's voice echoed loudly down the corridor.
"Has anyone tried to gain access to the vaults?"
he asked.
Yes, sir. There was a man trying to get in. They were just here."
"Who?" demanded Cuthbert. "Those people you were just speaking with?"
"Yes, sir. He had a form, but it hadn't been properly processed, so I didn't let him in."
"You did not let him in?"
"That's right, sir."
"Who issued the form? Frock?"
"Yes, sir. Dr. Frock."
"And you didn't get the name of this person?"
"I think his name was Bill. I don't know about the woman, but..."
"Bill? Bill? Oh, that's bloody brilliant. The first thing you should do is ask for identification."
"I'm sorry, sir. It was just that he insisted it was..."
But Cuthbert was already striding back angrily. The footfalls faded down the corridor. At a nod from Smithback, Margot rose gingerly and dusted herself off. They stepped out into the hall.
"Hey, you there," shouted the guard. "Come here, I need to see your ID. Wait!"
Smithback and Margo took off at a sprint. They raced around a bend, then ducked into a stairwell and dashed up the wide concrete steps.
"Where are we going?" Margo panted.
"Damned if I know."
They reached the next landing, and Smithback stepped out gingerly into the hallway. He looked up and down the corridor, then wrenched open a door marked Mammalogy, Pongidae Storage. Inside, they stopped to catch their breath. The room was quiet and cool. As Margot's eyes grew accustomed to the dim light, she noticed stuffed gorillas and chimpanzees standing in ranks like sentinels and heaping piles of hairy skins on wooden racks. Against one wall were dozens of shelves lined with primate skulls. Smithback listened intently at the door for a moment. Then he turned to Margot.
"Let's see what you found," he said.
"There wasn't much," Margot said, breathing heavily. "I took a couple of unimportant artifacts, that's it. I did find this, though," she said, reaching into her carryall. "It was wedged in the lid of the crate."
The unsealed envelope was addressed simply, R. H. Montague, NYMNH. The yellowed writing paper was embossed with a curious double arrow motif. As Smithback peered over her shoulder, Margot held the sheet carefully up to the light and began to read.
Upper Xingu, September 17th, 1987. Montague, I've decided to send Carlos back with the last crate and go on alone in search of Crocker. Carlos is trustworthy, and I can't risk losing the crate should anything happen to me. Take note of the shaman's rattle and other ritual objects. They seem unique. But the figurine I've enclosed, which we found in a deserted hut at this site, is the proof I've been looking for. Note the exaggerated claws, the reptilian attributes, the hints at bipedalia. The Kathoga exist, and the Mbuin legend is not mere fabrication. All my field notes are in this notebook.
31. Mrs. Lavinia Rickman sat in a wine-colored leather armchair in the director's office. The room was deathly silent. Not even traffic noises from the street three floors below penetrated the thick turret windows. Wright himself sat behind the desk, practically swallowed by the vast length of mahogany. A Reynolds portrait of Ridley A. Davis, the museum's founder, glared down from behind Wright. Dr. Ian Cuthbert occupied a sofa along a far wall of the room. He leaned forward, elbows on his knees, his tweed suit loose on his spare frame. He was frowning. Normally humorless and irritable, he looked particularly austere on this afternoon. Finally, Wright broke the silence.
"He's called twice already this afternoon," the director snapped at Cuthbert. "I can't avoid him forever. Sooner or later, he's going to raise a stink about being denied access to the crates. He may well drag this Mbuin business into it. There's going to be controversy."
Cuthbert nodded.
"As long as it's later rather than sooner. When the exhibition is open and running, with 40,000 visitors a day and favorable notices in all the periodicals, let him bloody well raise hell about whatever he likes."
There was another long silence.
"I hate to play the devil's advocate," Cuthbert continued at last. "But when the dust settles from all this, you, Winston, Henry, are going to have the necessary increase in attendance. These rumors of a curse may be annoying now, but when things are safe again, everyone's going to want a vicarious shudder and some scandal. Everyone's going to want to go inside the museum and see for themselves. It's good for business. I'm telling you, Winston, we couldn't have arranged it better ourselves."
Wright frowned at the assistant director. "Rumors of a curse. Maybe it's true. Look at all the disasters that have followed that ugly little figurine halfway around the world." He laughed mirthlessly.
"You're not serious," said Cuthbert.
"I'll tell you what I am serious about," Wright snapped. "I don't want to hear you talking like that again. Frock has important friends. If he starts complaining to them, well, you know how stories grow and spread. They'll think you're withholding information. They'll think you're banking on these killings, bringing people in to see the exhibition. How's that for publicity, eh?"
"Agreed,"
Cuthbert said with a wintry smile. But I don't need to remind you that if this exhibition doesn't open on time, everything becomes academic. Frock must be kept on a short leash. Now he's sending hired help to do his dirty work. One of them tried to get into the secure vault less than an hour ago.
Who? Wright demanded.
The security guard made a right hash of it, Cuthbert replied. But he got the fella's first name, Bill.
Bill? Rickman sat up.
Yes, I think that was it, Cuthbert said, turning to the public relations director. Isn't that the name of the journalist who's doing the book on my exhibition? He's your man, isn't he? Is he under control? I hear he's been asking a lot of questions.
Absolutely, said Rickman, a bright smile on her face. We've had our ups and downs with him, but he's towing the line now. Control the sources, and you've controlled the journalist, as I always say.
Towing the line, is he? Wright said. Then why did you feel it necessary to send that mail message round to half the Western world this morning, reminding them not to talk to strangers?
Mrs. Rickman quickly held up a lacquered hand. He's been taken care of.
You damn well better make sure of that, Cuthbert said. You've been in on this little party from the beginning, Lavinia. I'm sure you don't want this journalist of yours digging up any dirty knickers.
There came a hiss of static over the intercom, and a voice said,
Mr. Pendergast to see you.
Send him in, said Wright. He looked sourly at the others. This is it.
Pendergast appeared in the doorway, a newspaper tucked under one arm. He paused for a moment.
My, this is a charming tableau, he said. Dr. Wright, thank you for seeing me again. Dr. Cuthbert, always a pleasure. And you are Lavinia Rickman, ma'am, are you not?
Yes, Rickman replied, smiling primly.
Mr. Pendergast, said Wright, with a small formal smile, please take any seat you wish. Thank you, doctor, but I prefer to stand.
Pendergast moved over to the massive fireplace and leaned against the mantel, arms folded.
Have you come to make a report? No doubt you've asked for this meeting to inform us of an arrest.
No, said Pendergast, I'm sorry, no arrests. Frankly, Dr. Wright, we've made very little progress, despite what Ms. Rickman has been telling the newspapers.
He showed them the newspaper's headline, Arrest Near in Museum Beast Murders. There was a short silence. Pendergast folded the paper and carefully placed it on the mantelpiece.
What's the problem? Asked Wright. I don't understand what's taking so long.
There are many problems, as you are no doubt aware, said Pendergast, but I'm not really here to brief you on the case. It's enough if I remind you simply that a dangerous serial killer remains loose in the museum. We have no reason to believe he has stopped killing. As far as we know, all his killings have been nocturnal. In other words, after 5 p.m. As the special agent in charge of this investigation, I'm regretfully informing you that the curfew we've set up must remain in force until such time as the killer is found. There will be no exceptions.
The opening, Rickman bleated.
The opening will have to be postponed. It may be for a week, it may be for a month. I can't make any promises, I'm afraid. I'm very sorry.
Wright stood up, his face livid.
You said the opening could go on as scheduled, provided there were no more killings. That was our agreement.
I made no agreement with you, Doctor, Pendergast said mildly. I'm afraid we are no closer to catching the murderer than we were at the beginning of the week.
He gestured toward the newspaper on the mantel.
Headlines like these make people complacent, incautious. The opening would probably be very well attended. Thousands of people in the museum after dark.
He shook his head. I have no other choice.
Wright stared at the agent in disbelief.
Because of your incompetence, you expect us to delay the opening and do the museum irreparable harm in the process? The answer is no.
Pendergast, unruffled, walked forward into the center of the room.
Forgive me, Dr. Wright, if I didn't make myself clear.
I'm not here to ask your permission. I'm merely notifying you of my decision.
Right, the director answered, his voice shaking. I see. You can't do your own job, but you still want to tell me how to do mine. Do you have any idea what delaying the opening would do to our exhibition? Do you know what kind of message it would send to the public? Well, Pendergast, I'm not going to allow it.
Pendergast stared steadily at Wright. Any unauthorized personnel found on the premises after 5 o'clock will be arrested and charged with trespassing at a scene of crime. This is a misdemeanor. Second violations will be charged with obstruction of justice, which is a felony, Dr. Wright. I trust I make myself sufficiently clear.
The only thing that's clear right now is your path to the door, Wright said, his voice rising. It's unobstructed. Please take it.
Pendergast nodded.
Gentlemen? Ma'am?
Then he turned around and moved silently out of the room. Closing the door quietly, Pendergast stopped for a moment in the director's outer office. Then, staring at the door, he quoted,
"So I return rebuke to my content, and gain by ills thrice more than I have spent."
Wright's executive secretary stopped her gum-chewing in mid-snap. "How's that?" she inquired.
"No, Shakespeare,"
Pendergast replied, heading for the elevator. Inside, Wright fumbled at the telephone with shaking hands.
"What the hell happens now?" exploded Cuthbert. "I'll be damned if a bloody policeman's going to boot us out of our own museum."
"Cuthbert, be quiet," said Wright.
Then he spoke into the handset.
"Get me Albany right away."
There was a silence while he was put on hold. Wright looked over the receiver at Cuthbert and Rickman, controlling his heavy breathing with an effort.
"Time to call in some favors," he said. "We'll see who has the final word here. Some inbred albino from the Delta, or the director of the largest natural history museum in the world."
32.
The vegetation here is very unusual. The cycads and ferns look almost primordial. Too bad there isn't time for more careful study. We've used a particularly resilient variety as packing material for the crates. Feel free to let Jorgensen take a look if he's interested. I fully expect to be with you at the Explorers Club a month from now, celebrating our success with a brace of dry martinis and a good Macanudo. Until then, I know I can entrust this material and my reputation to you. Your colleague, Whittlesey.
Smithback looked up from the letter.
"We can't stay here. Let's go to my office."
His cubbyhole lay deep in a maze of overflow offices on the museum's ground level. The honeycomb passages, full of noise and bustle, seemed a refreshing change to Margot after the damp, echoing basement corridors outside the secure area. They walked past a large green dumpster overflowing with back issues of the museum's magazine. Outside Smithback's office, a large bulletin board was plastered with a variety of irate letters from subscribers for the amusement of the magazine staff. Once before, hot on the trail of an issue of Science long overdue from the periodical library, Margot had penetrated Smithback's messy lair. It was as she remembered it. His desk a riot of photocopied articles, half-finished letters, Chinese takeout menus, and numerous books and journals the museum's libraries were no doubt very eager to find.
"Have a seat," Smithback said, pushing a 2-foot stack of paper brusquely off a chair.
He closed the door, then walked around his desk to an ancient bentwood rocker. Paper crackled beneath his feet.
"Okay," he said in a low tone. "Now you're sure the journal wasn't there?"
"I told you, the only crate I had a chance to look at was the one Whittlesey packed himself. But it wouldn't have been in the others."
Smithbeck examined the letter again.
"Who's this Montague the thing's addressed to?" he asked.
"Don't know," Margot replied.
"How about Jorgensen?"
"Haven't heard of him, either."
Smithback pulled down the museum's telephone listing from a shelf.
"No Montague here," he murmured, flipping pages. "Of course, that might be a first name for all we know. Aha, here's Jorgensen. Botany.
Says he's retired. How come he still has an office?
Not unusual in this place, Margot replied. Independently wealthy people with little else to fill up their time. Where's his office?
Section 41, fourth floor, Smithback said, closing the book and dropping it on his desk. Near the herbarium. He stood up. Let's go.
Wait a minute, Smithback. It's almost 4 o'clock. I should call Frock and let him know what...
Later, Smithback said, making for the door. Come on, Lotus Blossom. My journalist's nose hasn't picked up a decent scent all day.
Jorgensen's office was a small, windowless laboratory with a high ceiling. It held none of the plants or floral specimens Margot expected to see in a botanist's lab. In fact, the room was empty, except for a large workbench, a chair, and a coat rack. A drawer of the workbench was open, exposing a variety of worn tools. Jorgensen was bending over the workbench, fiddling with a small motor.
Dr. Jorgensen? Smithback asked.
The old man turned and gazed at Smithback. He was almost completely bald, with bushy white eyebrows overhanging intense eyes of the color of bleached denim. He was bony and stooped, but Margot thought he must be at least 6'4".
Yes?
He said in a quiet voice. Before Margot could stop him, Smithback handed Jorgensen the letter. The man began reading, then started visibly. Without taking his eyes from the letter, he reached around for the battered chair and carefully eased himself into it.
"Where did you get this?"
he demanded when he had finished. Margot and Smithback looked at each other.
"It's genuine," Smithback said.
Jorgensen stared at them. Then he handed the letter back to Smithback.
"I don't know anything about this," he said.
There was a silence.
It came from the crate Julian Whittlesey sent back from the Amazon expedition 7 years ago, Smithback prompted, hopefully.
Jorgensen continued to stare at them. After a few moments, he returned to his motor. The two watched him tinker for a moment. I'm sorry we interrupted your work, Marco said at last. Perhaps this isn't a good time.
What work?
Asked Jorgensen without turning around.
Whatever that is you're doing, Margot replied.
Jorgensen suddenly barked out a laugh.
This, he said, turning to face him again, this isn't work. This is just a broken vacuum cleaner. Since my wife died, I've had to do the housework myself. Darn thing blew up on me the other day. I only brought it in here because this is where all my tools are. I don't have much work to do anymore.
About that letter, sir, Margot pressed. Jorgensen shifted in the creaky chair and leaned back, looking at the ceiling.
I hadn't known it existed. The double arrow motif served as the Whittlesey family crest, and that's Whittlesey's handwriting, all right. It brings back memories.
What kind? Asked Smithback eagerly.
Jorgensen looked over at him, his brows contracting with irritation.
Nothing that's any of your business, he said tartly. Or at least, I haven't heard just why it might be your business.
Margot shot Smithback a shut-up look. Dr. Jorgensen, she began, I'm a graduate student working with Dr. Frock. My colleague here is a journalist. Dr. Frock believes that the Whittlesey expedition and the crates that were sent back have a link to the museum murders.
A curse?
Said Jorgensen, raising his eyebrows theatrically.
No, not a curse, said Margot.
I'm glad you haven't bought into that one. There's no curse. Unless you define a curse as a mixture of greed, human folly, and scientific jealousy. You don't need Mbuun to explain...
He stopped.
Why are you so interested? He asked suspiciously.
To explain what?
Smithback interjected. Jorgensen looked at him with distaste.
Young man, if you open your mouth one more time, I'm going to ask you to leave.
Smithback narrowed his eyes but remained silent. Margot wondered if she should go into detail about Frock's theories, the claw marks, the damaged crate, but decided not to.
We're interested because we feel that there's a connection here that no one else is paying attention to. Not the police and not the museum. You were mentioned in this letter. We hoped you might be able to tell us more about this expedition.
Jorgensen held out a gnarled hand.
May I see that again?
Reluctantly, Smithback complied.
Jorgensen's eyes passed over the letter again, hungrily, as if sucking in memories.
There was a time, he murmured, I would have been reluctant to talk about this. Maybe afraid would be a better word. Certain parties might have sought to fire me, he shrugged. But when you get as old as I am, you don't have much to be afraid of, except maybe being alone.
He nodded slowly to Margot, clutching the letter.
I would have been on that expedition if it hadn't been for Maxwell.
He's mentioned in the letter, too. Who's he? Asked Smithback.
Jorgensen shot him a look.
I've knocked down bigger journalists than you, he snapped. Now I said be quiet, I'm talking to the lady.
He turned to Margot again.
Maxwell was one of the leaders of the expedition. Maxwell and Whittlesey. That was the first mistake, letting Maxwell muscle his way in, making the two of them co-leaders. They were at odds right from the beginning. Neither one had full control. Maxwell's gain was my loss. He decided they didn't have room for a botanist on the expedition, and that was it for me. But Whittlesey was even less happy about it than I. Having Maxwell along put his hidden agenda at risk.
What was that? Margot asked.
To find the Cathoga tribe. There were rumors of an undiscovered tribe living on a tepui, a vast tableland above the rainforest. Although the area had not been scientifically explored, the consensus was that the tribe was extinct, that only relics remained. Whittlesey didn't believe this. He wanted to be their discoverer. The only problem was the local government denied him a permit to study on the tepui. Said it was reserved for their own scientists. Yankee go home.
Jorgensen snorted, shook his head.
Well, what it was really being reserved for was depredation, land rape. Of course, the local government had heard the same rumors Whittlesey had. If there were Indians up there, the government didn't want them in the way of timbering and mining. So anyway, the expedition had to approach from the north. A much less convenient route, but away from the restricted area, and they were forbidden to ascend the tepui itself.
Did the Cathoga still exist? Margot asked.
Jorgensen slowly shook his head.
We'll never know. The government found something on top of that tepui. Maybe gold, platinum, placer deposits. You can detect lots of things with satellites these days. Anyway, the tepui was fired from the air in the spring of 88.
Fired? Margot asked.
Burned clear with napalm, Jorgensen said. Unusual and expensive to do it that way. Apparently the fire got out of hand, spread, burned uncontrollably for months. Then they built a big road in there, coming up the easy way from the south. They hauled in Japanese hydraulic mining equipment and literally washed away huge sections of the mountain. No doubt they leached the gold and platinum or whatever with cyanic compounds, then just let the poison run into the rivers. There's nothing, I mean nothing, left. That's why the museum never sent a second expedition down to search for the remains of the first.
He cleared his throat.
That's terrible, breathed Margot.
Jorgensen gazed up with his unsettling cerulean eyes.
Yes, it is terrible. Of course, you won't read about it in the superstition exhibition.
Smithback held up one hand while slipping out his microcassette recorder with the other.
Excuse me, may I? No, you may not record this. This is not for attribution, not for quotation, not for anything. I've received a memo to that effect just this morning, as you probably know. This is for me. I haven't been able to talk about this for years, and I'm going to do it now, just this once. So keep quiet and listen.
There was a silence. Where was I? Jorgensen resumed. Oh, yes. So, Whittlesey had no permit to ascend the tepui, and Maxwell was the consummate bureaucrat. He was determined to make Whittlesey play by the rules. Well, when you get out there in the jungle, 200 miles from any kind of government, what rules? He cackled. I doubt if anybody knows exactly what did happen out there. I got the story from Montague, and he pieced it together from Maxwell's telegrams, not exactly an unbiased source.
Montague? Smithback interrupted.
In any case, Jorgensen continued, ignoring Smithback, it appears Maxwell stumbled upon some unbelievable botany. Around the base of the Tapui, 99% of the plant species were absolutely new to science. They found strange, primitive ferns and monocotyledons that looked like throwbacks to the Mesozoic era. Even though Maxwell was a physical anthropologist, he went crazy over the strange vegetation. They filled up crate after crate with odd specimens. That was when Maxwell found those seed pods. How important were they? They were from a living fossil, not unlike the discovery of the coelacanth in the 1930s. A species from an entire phylum they thought had become extinct in the Carboniferous. An entire phylum.
Did these seed pods look like eggs?
Asked Margot. I couldn't say, but Montague got a look at them, and he told me they were hard as hell. They'd need to be buried deep in the highly acidic soil of a rainforest in order to germinate. I imagine they're still in those crates.
Dr. Frock thought they were eggs.
Frock should stick to paleontology. He's a brilliant man, but erratic. At any rate, Maxwell and Whittlesey had a falling out. Not unexpected. Maxwell couldn't care less about botany, but he knew a rarity when he saw one. He wanted to get back to the museum with his seed pods. He learned that Whittlesey intended to scale the Tapui and look for the Kathoga, and it alarmed him. He was afraid the crates would be seized at dockside, and he wouldn't get his precious pods out. They split up. Whittlesey went on deeper into the jungle, up the Tapui, and was never seen again. When Maxwell reached the coast with the rest of the expedition, he sent back a stream of telegrams to the museum, lambasting Whittlesey and telling his side of the story. Then he and the rest were killed in that plane crash. Luckily, arrangements had been made to ship the crate separately, or maybe it wasn't so lucky. It took the museum a year to untangle the red tape, get the crates back to New York. Nobody seemed in a big hurry to do it. He rolled his eyes in disgust.
You mentioned somebody named Montague, Margot asked quietly.
Montague, Jorgensen said, his eyes looking past Margot. He was a young Ph.D. candidate at the museum, anthropology, Whittlesey's protege. Needless to say, that didn't exactly put him in the museum's good graces after Maxwell's telegrams arrived. None of us who'd been friendly with Whittlesey were ever really trusted after that.
What happened to Montague?
Jorgensen hesitated. I don't know, he replied finally. He just disappeared one day, never came back.
And the crates, Margot pressed.
Montague had been terribly anxious to see those crates, especially Whittlesey's. But as I said, he was out of favor and had been taken off the project. In point of fact, there was no project anymore. The whole expedition had been such a disaster that the top brass just wanted to forget anything had happened. When the crates finally arrived, they sat unopened. Most of the documentation and provenance had burned up in the crash. Supposedly, there was a journal of Whittlesey's, but I never saw it. In any case, Montague complained and pleaded, and in the end they gave him the job of doing the initial curating, and then he just up and left.
What do you mean, left? Smithback asked.
Jorgensen looked at him, as if deciding whether or not to answer the question.
He simply walked out of the museum and never came back. I understand his apartment and all his clothes were abandoned. His family instituted a search and found nothing. But he was a rather strange character. Most people assumed he'd gone off to Nepal or Thailand to find himself.
But there were rumors, Smithback said. It was a statement, not a question.
Jorgensen laughed. Of course there were rumors. Aren't there always? Rumors that he embezzled money, rumors that he ran off with a gangster's wife, rumors that he'd been murdered and dumped in the East River. But he was such a non-entity in the museum that most people forgot about him in a few weeks.
Rumors that the museum beast got him?
Smithback asked.
Jorgensen's smile faded. Not exactly. But it caused all the rumors of the curse to resurface. Now everyone, they said, who had come in contact with the crates had died. Some of the guards and cafeteria employees, you know those types, said Whittlesey had robbed a temple, that there was something in the crate, a relic with a terrible curse on it. They said the curse followed the relic all the way back to the museum. Didn't you want to study the plants that Maxwell sent back? Smithback asked. I mean, you're a botanist, aren't you? Young man, you know nothing of science. There is no such thing as a botanist, per se. I have no interest in the paleobotany of angiosperms. That whole thing was way out of my field. My specialty is the coevolution of plants and viruses. Or was, he said with a certain irony. But Whittlesey wanted you to take a look at the plants he sent back as packing material, Smithback continued. I have no idea why, Jorgensen said. This is the first I've heard of it. I never saw this letter before. With a certain reluctance, he handed it back to Margot. I'd say it's a fake, except for the handwriting and the motif. There was a silence.
You haven't said what you thought about Montague's disappearance, Margot said at last.
Jorgensen rubbed the bridge of his nose and looked at the floor.
It frightened me.
Why?
There was a long silence.
I am not sure, he finally said. Montague once had a financial emergency and had to borrow money from me. He was very conscientious and went through great difficulties paying it back. It didn't seem in character for him to just disappear like that. The last time I saw him, he was about to do an inventory of the crates. He was very excited about it.
He looked up at Margot.
I'm not a superstitious man. I'm a scientist. Like I said, I don't believe in curses and that sort of thing.
His voice trailed off.
But,
Smithback prodded. The old man shot a glance at Smithback.
Very well, he glowered.
Then he leaned back in his chair and looked at the ceiling.
I told you that Julian Whittlesey was my friend, he said. Before he left, Whittlesey had collected all the stories he could find about the Cathoga tribe, mostly from lowland tribes living downstream, Yanomamo and the like. I remember him telling me one story the day before he left. The Cathoga, according to a Yanomamo informant, had made a deal with a being called Zalashki. This was a creature like our Mephistopheles, but even more extreme. All the evil and death in the world emanated from this thing, which slithered around on the peak of the Tapui, or so the legend went. Anyway, according to their arrangement, the Cathoga would get the Zalashki's child for a servant, in return for killing and eating all of their own children, and vowing forevermore to worship him and only him. When the Cathoga had finished their grisly task, the Zalashki sent his child to them. But the beast proceeded to run rampant through the tribe, murdering and eating people. When the Cathoga complained, the Zalashki laughed and said, "What did you expect? I am evil." Finally, using magic or herbal spells or some such thing, the tribe managed to control the beast. It couldn't be killed, you see. So the Zalashki child remained under the control of the Cathoga, and they used it to do their own malignant bidding. But using it was always a dangerous proposition. The legend says that the Cathoga have been looking for a way to get rid of it ever since.
Jorgensen looked down at the disassembled motor.
That was the story Whittlesey told me. When I heard about the plane crash, the death of Whittlesey, the disappearance of Montague, well, I couldn't help but think the Cathoga had finally managed to get rid of Zalashki's child.
Picking up a piece of the machine, the old botanist turned it over in his hands with a distant expression.
Whittlesey told me the name of the Zalashki's child was Mbun. He who walks on all fours.
And he dropped the piece with a clank and grinned. 33.
As closing drew near, the visitors began to trickle out toward the museum exits. The museum shop, located directly inside the south entrance, did a brisk business. In the marble hallways leading away from the south entrance, the sounds of conversation and the drumming of feet could be clearly heard. In the Hall of the Heavens near the west entrance, where the opening party for the new exhibition was to be held, the noise was fainter.